Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Yourself, hopefully not. Reach out, ladies and gentlemen, reach out. Unless, of course, you feel like it's a brilliant idea to sit back, do absolutely nothing, and wind up getting ruthlessly exterminated by world government forces. Right, you listen to the Vinny Eastwood Show, and I've got some very good news for you, ladies and gentlemen. I just anybody knows from New Zealand knows that the New Zealand Herald is the country's largest newspaper, a country of 4 million people. Yeah, it was large enough. Anyway, I sent them a message this morning, and I'm going to read that one out for you in just a second, but it goes to the point where you understand that the mainstream media, they're not actually being listened to that much anymore as people turn in droves to alternative media. So I sent them a message, and I said, hey, guys, I just wanted to let you know that for the last 4 years I've been making my own independent news and putting it up on YouTube. I now have more subscribers on my channel than you guys do. I was particularly proud of this because New Zealand Herald TV, until a few days ago, was New Zealand's largest YouTube news channel. If you'd like to interview me and find out why people are flocking to view my content, please get in touch. Vinny Eastwood, Mr. News. I doubt they'll get back in touch. But who cares? They suck and I frickin' rule! See? The alternative media is growing exponentially, and we're going to eclipse these fracks. Isn't that right? Now, our very special guest today, Mr. Liam Sheff. Liam, welcome to the program.
Hi, Vinny. How are you?
Somewhat fabulous as my party line. So why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Well, I'm here in the heart I'm here in the heart of the Death Star. I'm here in Lazatas, you need the United States. I grew up here. I'm 41. I grew up in a family of doctors, researchers, and scientists. I had a very unusual life, very, very strange childhood. I saw way too many strange things at a young age. I became a journalist somewhere in my late 20s, early 30s. I'm 41 again. Coming from that background of scientists and doctors, I grew up with this notion at family dinners that science was something to be fought about, argued about, debated. It wasn't a fact. Facts change was the first lesson I ever had in my life. Facts change because every 6 months they'd be arguing a new fact, the previous fact having gone the way of the dodo. So cancer was caused by hormones until it wasn't caused, until it was caused by some cellular thing, until it was caused by accidental gene shuffling, until it was caused, well, they're still not sure. They don't want to know. The mainstream doesn't want to know. They never want to know, as you know. So when I got into journalism, I wrote from the point of view of somebody who was perfectly willing to be critical of the sciences. I had no fear in that because I'd been schooled so well. I started writing about something called AIDS, which is essentially a brand name for poverty in Africa and major drug abuse in ghettoized gay communities, especially here in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, that's been sold to the world as a sex disease. Now, that's the shortcut version, and I can answer that in long form with all of the accompanying details, but that's the short form. Once you get through that, you realize that almost everything you've been told is a lie, so then you have to go into vaccination. You look at vaccines. You go, oh, wow, nobody really ever got better injecting stuff that's grown in monkey testicles mixed with aluminum, formaldehydes, and squalene into anybody. Nobody ever got better doing that, and a lot of people are made sick. Then you move on to the other sciences. Where do you go? You go to astronomy. You realize that the Big Bang is a kind of a myth that was actually invented by a priest. It's not a scientific idea. Then you end up in Darwinism, and you go, wow, the survival of the fittest actually isn't a scientific notion. You can't predict how a cell emerged through by saying, oh, the fit survive. You end up somewhere else. So I walked through all of the sciences. And I wrote a book called Official Stories, came out a month ago, a month and a half, and somebody must have said, Vinny Eastwood, you're down there fighting the good fight. Have this guy on.
Yeah, well, whoever that listener is, and this is the thing, ladies and gentlemen, I don't take this seriously. You know, a lot of people, they want to do heaps of research and they want to document everything and they want to print out stuff and they want to make sure that there's records and blah, 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 blah. Me, I'm just like, does it get done? Yeah? Okay, then let's do it. What else do you need? I mean, Liam, we've got you here. We're on the radio. We're recording. It's being done. The fact that I don't know who you are or who invited you, I think is a misnomer.
Well, that's clever. I wasn't trying to put you on the spot. I actually looked you up, and I was enjoying your take down the mainstream with a smile and a laugh. It's something that I try to do here. We have Alex Jones over here. Do you know Alex?
Oh yeah,
yeah. And we have, and I like him. I mean, he's a groundbreaker. And then we have David Icke, who's sort of up and out and a little bit beyond. And isn't really trying to do news as much as he's trying to. Well, he's got his own worldview, and then we've got Mike Adams at Natural News. Mike leans more on the health freedom side of things. I don't know what it's like there in New Zealand. It's a smaller country, I assume, with a smaller government. You're not invading anybody at present, are you?
Well, we just signed up to NATO without any permission from the people of New Zealand. Our Prime Minister just basically signed the document. So wherever the hell NATO is, and they're the ones who invade all the countries now, we'll be sure to go now.
So, right. So we've got Jones, and he's very serious, you know. And if you listen to him, you're always sort of worried he's going to stroke out right on the air, you know. And he's just very, very, you know, very serious. But you like him because he does tell the truth. His hit and miss ratio is probably in the 40s. You know, he's probably 40 on, 60 off, which is better than the mainstream news, which lies all the time. Mike Adams runs Natural News. You go to naturalnews.com, and I'm on a radio show there with Robert Scott Bell. And I really lean on the health freedom aspect. I don't. Our government x-rays us every time we travel, unless you opt out, in which case you run the risk of being impregnated by some high school dropout who happens to be working for the TSA. So it's not pretty over here. I mean, everything feels more tight and constrained. And every time we have one of these things blow up, like this crazy, crazy, crazy neurological, neuromedicine sciences student, recipient of government money, by the way, shooting people to death in a movie theater. Well, accused of shooting people to death in the movie theater. Everybody sort of buckles down one more, and I think the thing that the New World Order people want us to do over here in the States is to be in a position of that of Israelis, where we say, well, the Palestinians are always trying to kill us, so if we have men here on the street with guns, it's for our own safety, and if you need to see my own papers, it's for my own good.
I have an interesting anecdote on that, though, because they tried that back in the day when Palestinians, instead of doing suicide bombs, they were using AK-47s and shooting up shopping malls, stuff like that. The Israeli government found out that putting troops on every street didn't work, because the person on the street is actually at the mercy of the terrorist, because he's sitting there all day, and as soon as his shift's over, the terrorist can just sit there lying in wait and all of a sudden appear. So they tried something different. They tried concealed carry permits. And so they had lots of old ladies and people walking around all over the place just with guns in their handbags and stuff like that. And there was this one shopping mall, I think it was on a Monday afternoon, a nice beautiful day. These three Palestinian terrorists with AK-47s opened up on this big crowd in this mall. And to their shock and surprise, the crowd started shooting back and killed two of them, wounded the third one. And the ambulance arrived and they picked up the wounded guy and they're taking him back. And the paramedics told the story that the guy was beside himself, absolutely beside himself, just miserable, crying, just going, nobody told us the old ladies would have guns.
Well,
think about that. That's law enforcement right there. Hold on a second. Are the people completely defenseless and capable of being taken out? Why, no. They're capable of defending themselves. Okay. Do we have that much more need for terribly large amounts of troops, police on the streets anymore? No. It turns out it's a lot cheaper and more effective because we're everywhere.
So what happened as a result? Because there are, you know, there are armed, they're not Mossad, they're armed Israeli forces, you know, if you go to the cities. What happened as a result? I don't know. Does Israel have a concealed permit law?
Yeah, they've got more concealed carries per capita than any other country on earth, I think.
Well, and yet,
as well as troops every now and again, and what I've seen and been told from friends of mine who've been to Gaza on relief missions and things like that is that a lot of the troops are on checkpoints, hilltops, things like that, places where they can see and intimidate the people who are living in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank sort of thing, behind their big walls with their big tanks and their big guns and all of that kind of stuff. And it seems that they're not there for protection. They're there for intimidation. And the protection that the Israelis have is actually from their own armed citizenry who are everywhere and can protect them at any time. But because of that concealed carry permits, the Palestinians stopped their tactics and they stopped using machine guns and things like that to pull off their attacks. Instead, now it's turned to suicide bombers, and a gun ain't going to save you against a suicide bomber.
No, it's not. That's an interesting story. So the militia is, again, at the service of the international bankers and the property owners and debt leveragers, so they're wanting to leverage parts of the West Bank. And Palestine sort of gets whittled away. And the Israelis, though, themselves, you're saying, have a perfect ability to defend themselves from any actual armed incursion. So our government, under the strange socialism that's been creeping in, and I'm not talking about Norwegian socialism where everybody pays into the pot and everybody gets retirement benefits and, you know, the population or Swedish socialism where everybody is essentially the same ethnicity, essentially from the same lineage. A country is easier to manage when everybody feels that they're the same, but as soon as you have plurality, people group up one against each other because we're a strange tribal species that way. We just like to do that. So here in America, there are all kinds of people, which I think is a good thing. But we still, it just means that we're always torn up about it. We're always looking for somebody to help us get along with each other because we generally will fight if given the opportunity. And one thing that this country used to have was that a number of people had guns. But that's considered sort of passé, and it's also considered a little bit rough, and we're supposed to be a more civilized nation. But that's the fight that's coming up now as the UN, I believe around the world, is pushing a retraction, a ban on, what is it called, a small arms treaty? In other words, nobody should be allowed to carry concealed weapons. Do you know this one?
Oh, yeah. And they've been working on this for years and years and years. It's basically like the founding principle of the UN, disarm everybody and enslave everybody else.
So what do you know about the first stuff that I popped into? Because if you haven't read the book and you haven't known the articles, I guess the story I should tell for an audience who doesn't know me is what happens here in the name of HIV and AIDS. So tell me what you know, what you think.
artificial virus created as a biological warfare weapon, basically, that is 50 times more likely to bond with your DNA and infect you if you're a black person rather than a white person. And the first three incidences of AIDS being reported all happened, I think, within the same period of time, three different locations inside South African borders, all of which of these three locations were within 5 miles of a U.S. Military bioweapons research lab. Or at least these are the things that I've been told, and I could be wrong.
Yeah, that's not true. I'll tell you a different version of it. That's the sci-fi version. That's sort of the conspiracy version that unfortunately gives science and scientists way too much power. And that's the problem that we have at times. I think we tend to make scientists into gods, but I can tell you, growing up with them, they're overweight, people who drink too much booze, and they mess around with cell cultures. They don't really know what they're looking at. They have a technology that magnifies the microscopic to the point that it really loses meaning. It doesn't have any real meaning outside of what they're doing in the lab. So let me tell you another story. And here I go. In the 1970s, we had a president in this country called Richard Nixon, who was incredibly popular. That's irony. He was not popular. He was pretty well hated by what was then a liberal backlash against the Vietnam War, which was just a murder-suicide pact that young men were put on, 18, 19-year-olds, to go over there. The youngest person, I believe, who died in the Vietnam War, by the way, American, was 15. The youngest Vietnamese was unborn, if you understand what I'm saying. The Vietnam War left a legacy of millions, millions, and millions of dead, and the kind of deformity, you just look up Agent Orange Monsanto Vietnam deformity. It's something, it's the karma that we're just never going to stop paying back. The United States never paid a war debt. We didn't even build a bloody hospital. So the Vietnam War was going on. Richard Nixon was hung up on something called the Watergate break-in. It was a very, essentially a minor thing compared to what really goes on in politics, that he was trying to maneuver some of the election.
Well, unfortunately, Liam, we've come to a break, so we'll be back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen, with Liam Sheff. You can look him up online, liamsheff.com. That's S-C-H-E-F-F. Back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Like me, yeah, yeah, yeah. Congratulations, you made it. Welcome to the Crusader. It's been a long time coming, yo.
Yeah,
but I'm here now. So what you wanna do?
Huh?
How many dudes you really know can flow like this?
Like this,
let's do it. How many dudes you know vote like this? How many dudes you know flow like this? Not many, if any, not many, if any. How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show like this? I don't know anybody. Check to the mic, check a 1-2 from a crew coming through. Are you hype yet?
Ladies and gentlemen,
wanna talk, baby, got some subscribe.
You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. The show that's all about trying to keep it gangster in the Rockefeller sense of the word. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com. My very special guest, who I'm actually starting to kind of like a bit, because he's actually got a bit of a sense of humor, but he's also very serious and very onto it, and he seems to have a lot of research behind him. I like people like that because they're actually a good counterbalance to me, because I'm normally pretty fracking flippant at times. Liam Sheff, welcome back.
Hey.
We were talking about HIV and AIDS, and something you told me over the break was that if you tested everybody for HIV in the whole world, you get like, what, 70% positive or something like that?
Right, because the tests aren't specific. And what I posted in our chat panel, and I'm sorry, I'm not on the chat pane, and if I do the chat pane with the talk show, I'll be distracted, and I'll be answering people who are typing, so I can't go look at it. But what I just sent to you was something from the standard HIV test, which says, and I'll read to you, it's from Abbott Laboratories, and it's repeated in all of the worldwide tests. At present, there is no recognized standard for establishing the presence or absence, then they say, of antibodies to HIV. Let me say that again. At present, there is no recognized standard for establishing the presence or absence of HIV. They use antibodies to stand in for the thing. So you're two distances away already. There is no standard for telling whether you are or are not infected. That's what HIV tests say. In other words, they're not HIV tests. But how did they get there? Richard Nixon was an unpopular president. He put $100 million of U.S. money, 1971 money, real money, before I think he crippled it and took it off the gold standard, into something called the war on cancer. We were going to fight a war on cancer. And by the way, this is all in my book, Chapter 6 of Official Stories, which will be on Kindle for people around the world in September. So, but if you're in Europe, you can buy it. And in America, you can buy it on Amazon. So he put $100 million in, and these guys were going to find a virus that caused cancer. This is very tricky stuff, because we don't read, just like the hoi polloi in the Middle Ages didn't read Latin. They didn't all read Latin, so they couldn't tell what the church fathers were saying or doing. And when the Pope said, "I am the vicar of Jesus Christ on earth," because it says so in this document, you can't read or understand, they went, "Whatever, I guess you are. You know,
trust me, I'm the Pope.
Trust me, I'm the guy in charge. Give me your money." Until he began taking so much money that even Martin Luther, good, monk in wherever, Saxony, Bavaria, said, "Screw you. Not only do I want to have a girlfriend, but I'm tired of paying you all my money." So you can have a rebellion, but only after a while. So we don't read the papers that are published by the scientific elite. We think that they're honest in their papers. That's the big laugh. I happen to be able to read those papers, and so can you if you put your mind to it. It's not indecipherable. It's just something people aren't accustomed to doing. The story of AIDS goes like this. They were looking for a virus that caused cancer. Hold. They weren't looking for a virus. They stopped looking for viruses. Viruses are wildly misunderstood. The thing that we call the polio virus is a pretty harmless stomach bug. The reason people got polio in this country is because we were spraying DDT on them, on their food. It's a potent organochlorine neurotoxin. It destroys nerve cells. It kills small animals. We sprayed it on babies. We sprayed it on children at the beach. Lo and behold, they developed palsies. That was polio. Before we were doing that, we in the United States were putting lead and arsenic, copper and arsenic, heavy metal neurotoxins, on apples. We were putting it on orchard fruit. Children were eating it. They were developing palsies or infantile paralysis. They then traded that for DDT, which is still in the ecosystem worldwide. So we misunderstand viruses. They're usually just little bits of cellular debris. They're now called exosomes by some people. They're little bits of information that bubble out of degrading cells. They're not things that generally cause huge problems. We're talking about a body that's really, really screwed up and out of whack is going to be expressing all kinds of weird cellular instability. And that's kind of what we are calling viruses. So they stopped looking for viruses. They started looking for an enzyme. And this is as wonky as it gets, and I'll pull back to the macroscopic story in a second. But they started to look for an enzyme. The enzyme they called reverse transcriptase. They said it was very special. They said it only occurred among certain viruses. They knew they were wrong. It's a normal enzyme. It occurs in all cells all the time, in pregnant women, in animals, insects, birds, beasts, etc. But that's what they did. And if you read the papers, you'll see what I'm talking about. They stopped looking for any particular particle. They started looking for, and it's all very voodoo stuff because you can't hold an enzyme in your hand. Then they stopped looking for the bloody enzyme and they just started looking for some proteins. And they said, if we find some proteins in these people, those must have come from a virus. I swear this is it. Then they stopped looking. They said, we don't need to find any particular virus and we don't need to show that it does anything. The 70s had one, and just hold that thought, reverse transcriptase. The 70s had something going on. We had the sexual revolution in this country, in America. I don't know how it was in New Zealand, but we had this thing called the sexual revolution.
That happened here too, and I've come up with the conclusion that the 70s is the only decade that can be used as its own excuse. Like, for example, mate, did you ever do drugs or anything? Hey, it was the 70s.
Oh my God, yes. The whole culture was having a really good bad time. But what was the real sexual revolution about? The human species didn't change identity over a period of 3 years.
I thought the sexual revolution was about the Rockefellers financing feminism and basically getting the women into the workforce so that they could tax and control and borrow money on both strains of income rather than just the fathers. And as a result, they can also drive down real wages for everybody so that now you desperately need two incomes to support a household.
I like that answer, and I think it's true. But what made it possible for there to be a sexual revolution? The thing that used to stand in the way of young men having sex with anybody they wanted was one little thing called biology. Women used to get pregnant when you had sex with them. But in the 1959-60, this thing called the birth control pill became available for a prescription and then a non-prescription.
Amazing. Who developed that pill by chance? Was it a Rockefeller-funded research pharmaceutical organization of some description?
I wish I had that answer on the tip of my brain. There's a good – I hate public television over here because it is all Rockefeller TV, but they actually did a thing. And if you look it up, you can find out. But everything – you put the word Rockefeller in there, everything came out of eugenics studies, what was called eugenics. And you had the research institutes at Harvard, Yale, and you had the New York – Columbia and Cold Spring Harbor, New York. And the ones that used to be eugenics labs, which figured out who could breed and who couldn't and who was fit and who was unfit and who should be sterilized, are now genetics labs. They're practicing the same sort of voodoo rituals, but liberals will still go at science. And you go, look, it's not scientific to tell me that everybody who's black in Africa has a sex disease because, frankly, they're more conservative in their sexual practices than any girl I ever met at college. Than any boy I met, you know what I'm saying? The bright and beautiful kids who get to go to school and go to college screw each other's brains out in the dorms. Condoms come off. I mean, girls are hysterical. Like, you know, I really trust you. I don't like condoms, you know. And then we go to Africa, and everybody's like, oh, the dark continent. Yes, the Negro has a kind of sex that kills him. All right, so how did that happen? The gay population in this country wanted the same sexual revolution, but they didn't get it until the 70s. There's a reason why AIDS happened among it. Where was the lesbian AIDS epidemic? It never happened. Where was the heterosexual white AIDS epidemic? Never happened. Why did it happen among gay men? It happened for one reason. They were men. They were men who liked men. And if you know anything about men, young men have no boundaries. They think about sex all the time. Men who go with women have to tolerate the fact that women think we are disgusting when we just talk about sex too openly. They humiliate us. They shame us. They make us remember their names, their phone numbers, our anniversaries, when we want to go out for lunch or dinner, all this kind of...
That's total jackal hen pecking, though, because I've seen plenty of girls talk about sexual stuff, and they'd say things that even I, one of the dirtiest people that I know, would never even conceive of talking about. It's just gross.
I know women are hysterical that way, but before when they weren't on the pill, it was easier for them to get pregnant, and historically, during the length of the species, and if you look at this during the in literature about men and women through the length of the human species, women are more protected. Why? Because they can get pregnant. Because suddenly you're going to align two forces with each other because two kids thought they liked each other for 10 minutes. So there were a lot of rules governing male-female conduct. But men, and I'm very, by the way, I don't judge or care about gender identity. I think homosexuality is natural. I think it occurs naturally in the human species, and I have no issue with it. That's my opinion. I don't expect it. Agree with me, and I don't.
In fact, I was talking to a gay friend of mine today, Paul Carruthers, who's exposing a lot of scumbaggery down here in New Zealand, and he's really upset that he gets discriminated against for being gay. And I said to him, look, bro, here's the thing. You judge people on one thing only, the content of their character, and yours is flawless.
Exactly. It's irrelevant to me. It's also natural to me in the human species because it just makes sense to me that some people will be same-sex oriented. It's just something the human species does. It doesn't bother me. But young men get away. Firstly, they're isolated. They're thrown. America's a very homophobic place, and they're thrown out. And in the 50s, you could be murdered. You could be killed. People were murdered. People were murdered in the 80s for being homosexual on the street. So they're thrown out. By the way, their mothers cry, oh, my son, my son. Their fathers say, not in this house. You're not my son anymore. They leave Idaho. They leave Arkansas. They leave Texas. And they run to New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, where they form ghettoized little communities. And by ghettoized, in New York and Chelsea, you live in high rises. You live in low. You live in tenements. They're dirty. You have as many that you can't go home. You can't get married. You can't move in together. There's no point. Then you're a guy. You're driven by testosterone. If you're not going to be able to pursue any of the niceties of culture, you might as well do what you feel like doing. You might as well have that sexual revolution. And what happened to young men was that as quickly as I can finish this sentence, they had a new partner. And I'm not making it up. I'm not judging it. I'm describing it, and I'm describing it from my friends who lived through it. I mean, I have friends. Yes, I stood on the stoop. A guy walked by, came into the house. We had fun. He left. Happened again that night. Then we went to the club. I had four partners that night. That means that you're going to have so many STDs that you have to take chronic antibiotics. When you take chronic antibiotics, you puncture your intestine. Now, modern mainstream science will tell you that 80% of your functional immune system is right here in your gut. I'm touching my stomach. It's right here in your intestine. All of those 100 trillion bacteria, or whatever it is, 100 trillion trillion bacteria, are taking apart food. They're taking apart the bad bacteria. They're taking apart things so they can go into your blood. Antibiotics are like Agent Orange in your intestine. They defoliate it. They make your intestine porous. You then start leaking into your blood. You then have massive inflammatory problems, as we see in people with lupus and fibromyalgia. These are all punctured gut illnesses. These guys then took more antibiotics. They were also on a host of party drugs so long that a gay activist called Larry Kramer wrote a list of about 67 different drugs that would be used at any particular party on any given weekend. It was 60 or 70. And these include opium, and they include heroin, and they include cocaine, and then they include...
Didn't the government ship in all that drugs and just distribute it through local gangs and stuff like that to just flood the whole black communities with crack and everything in the 80s?
Heroin was brought in large amount by on U.S. convoys coming back from Vietnam. And there was a what we call a gangster, a drug lord in New York. I think I want to call him Frank Lucas, but I might be getting that name right. Anyway, Ridley Scott made a movie about it. But it was facilitated by the U.S. military. And then the CIA got involved, according to all reasonable reporting, even admitted at this point, got involved in trafficking cocaine for money, to get weapons, people to butcher people in South America, to keep so-called democracy. I'm making quotes in the air with my fingers. So the gay community is then bombarded by drugs. They're ghettoized and isolated, and they begin to get sick. They begin to wear out. It just so happens that these guys who were working on a virus that, not working on inventing, but working on deciphering, oh, does a virus cause cancer? These gay guys walked in. Their guts are ruined. They walk into the hospital. They're given even harder antibiotics like Cipro. They're given all sorts of very, very toxic treatments, and they expire. They expire pretty quickly. A great hue and cry grows up. The first analysis of this called it a lifestyle disease. Well, it wasn't that they were homosexual. It was that they were young, wildly using antibiotics and a host of other drugs that just render you... They went without sleep for weeks and months in essence. And nobody gave a damn about them. Nobody gave it. And the conservatives in this country, the sort of virulent, ferocious ones, said, well, God hates fags. You know, that's actually...
I love that family. You know, it's just, if anything's going to teach your kids to be really nice, loving, caring parents and individuals themselves, it's certainly holding a sign outside a soldier's funeral that says, God hates fags. You know, that's just his prime parenting there, isn't it, America? We'll be right back after the break. The fabulous Liam Sheff from Liam Sheff. I'm back in a minute.
Ain't got no Schwarzenegger sense of the word. Sydney Eastwood Show.
On AmericanFreedomRadio.com, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, which is also, incidentally, as well as being fluoridated, Fukushima irradiated, where everybody has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. It's great. You've got to love this place, man. It's clean. It's green. And by clean, I mean there's no possibility that you would ever, ever be able to charge a politician here with corruption, no matter how corrupt they are. And by green, I mean that they actually literally spray and drop the most toxic poison on earth, painted green with green dye, of course, into pristine bushland and the water catchment areas, which can disrupt endocrine systems and everything if they're at one part per trillion, as it turns out. That's clean and green New Zealand, baby. You've got to love it. Liam Sheff is my guest. Welcome back, sir.
Is that you guys are fluoridated?
Oh, yeah.
Ugh. Ugh.
That's why they call it a new world order, Liam, because there ain't much of a difference. Like, if I go to the United States now and I'll see everything, it's kind of like that scene in Pulp Fiction, you know, where he says, you know, they got the same crap there that they got here, but it's just a little bit different, you know? Like, you can go into a McDonald's and buy a beer. I'm talking about like a glass of beer, you know? Little differences, but everything's basically the same. So you've got corrupt politicians? We've got corrupt politicians. Have you got crazy mofos walking around doing biological experiments on the population without their permission? Yeah, we got that too. Have you got anybody installing copious quantities of smart meters all connected to massive telecommunication companies that attended Bilderberg Group meetings? Yeah, we got that too. You know, same stuff, different country.
Bollocks. What a drag. Okay, let me wrap up this bit. We were there with the gay guys destroying themselves in the communities with no love from the culture, and we're back with the scientists making believe that cancer is caused by virus. By the way, cancer is multifactorial, toxicological. You were just talking about it. All the stuff that they spray, drop, and infuse us with and inject us with, these cause cancer over time if we don't detox. And, you know, God help us. We have to work very hard at all of this now, at this detoxification. So the mainstream loves to blame one thing. That's why they love viruses. They love viruses because viruses don't do much. And they're not really mostly viruses. They're just cellular detritus. They love them because they can blame something, like for this new seal flu. Clearly, these seals were poisoned. There's so much pollution and poison in the water to blame a flu. Is like, I don't know. It's like me punching myself in the arm and blaming the Wizard of Oz. It's just nonsensical. It's not even a good... Insane.
I can imagine what a seal flu kind of sounds like.
But how do they do it? And the American public just sort of goes, well, I better get vaccinated. Now we vaccinate people in schools and in supermarkets. Do you know this? We vaccinate people in the bloody supermarket. I mean, you go in.
Oh, my God.
I know. So, okay. So what happens? The gay community is sick. They're looking for a way out. They're blamed essentially by Dr. Gottlieb. They say, well, it's a lifestyle disease. You guys are doing too many drugs, and you've destroyed yourself. And they say, no, that's not acceptable. It can't be anything that we did. We can't take any responsibility and blame it on something invisible that affects everybody. Well, a guy called Robert Gallo comes along. Robert Gallo had faked his research for 10 years at the NIH. He would have been accused of faking his research. He said that a virus caused cancer, and he had sort of negative correlations, negative proofs. He was accused of mixing samples of just laboratory junk, you know, mixing three monkey samples together and faking it. And nobody really trusted him, but for some reason, he came out and said, well, the stuff that I used to said caused cancer that didn't, now it causes, well, these guys don't have cancer, but they have pneumonia and they have weak immune systems. So now it causes that. But it's not an it. Remember, we're not finding viruses. They make a test out of it. This is the most important part. They make a test out of it. They call it first an HTLV-3 test, but that name is too hard to say, so they brand it differently. They call it HIV. It's just a rebranding. They say that the test tests for, well, not a particular virus, but for your likelihood that you will one day get sick a little bit before maybe we think you should. And that's about as clear as it is. It's a non-specific test. The test is made out of proteins. The proteins came from the samples, and I'm not kidding, you can look this up, of 10 guys who were mixed together with previously existing cancer cells. Previously existing cancer, they called immortal cell lines because they never died. They were T cells. They were immortal. AIDS is supposed to be a disease of T cells. Let me say that again. The T cell, the cells that never died, that were called immortal, were T cells. Are we done yet? You know, they started.
Well, hold on a second. I think that's probably also a good movie reference in here. Have you ever seen Resident Evil?
Yeah.
What was the virus that kept everybody alive and not dying, kept them as virus? The T virus.
Was it? There you go. So
yeah.
It's always popping up. You know, the X-Files. The X-Files, which was very popular here in the 90s, they always traded in sort of what was happening in the science papers. So Sculler and Mulder, whatever their names were, Mulder and Scully would one day like be infected with an alien virus, and by the end of the episode, even though they had sort of turned into clams or some weird sea creature for most of the episode, they would just give them a little shot of what they called an antiretroviral, and they'd be better. So the media always plays with this. But the reality is these tests test for everything. HIV tests aren't HIV tests. And we have a group here in America called the Office of Medical and Scientific Justice that's now defended 40 cases where people were accused of spreading HIV. In 30 of the cases, the charges under oath in court, under review in court, were thrown out because you cannot prove that any of the people are infected with anything, because HIV tests don't test for anything. The mainstream, though, devised a kind of a drug. Now, what was happening in the gay community wasn't enough. They then expanded it to interesting groups like heroin addicts. Heroin addicts, known for their good health and their long, long lives. Nope, sorry, these are people who die in their 20s, early 30s. Then hemophiliacs, another group of people known for their resilience and lasting. No, again, people who are marred, unfortunately, from childhood, very difficult lives. They started looking at these people. They included them in the AIDS group. Suddenly, they expanded the group from gay men who were destroying themselves to hemophiliacs and heroin addicts. Then they did the biggest trick that you can do. A guy called Joseph McCormick, and he wrote a book about it, went to Africa, went to Bangui, the capital of the Central African Republic, in 85, and at a meeting, a WHO meeting, World Health Organization, said, "As if we can start counting cases of AIDS in Africa, even though the way that we count them will be different than that of the United States, at least we'll be counting something." The way they counted cases in Africa was very different than in any Western country. They looked for a number of what they called signs. The signs would be, number one, that's right, weight loss. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to sub-Saharan Africa or seen pictures from sub-Saharan Africa or even read anything from any of the sewage conditions of sub-Saharan Africa, but it's really hard to get a clean drink of water in a lot of sub-Saharan Africa.
Let me get this straight. They're going to a place where everybody's starving and has dysentery to look for people who are losing weight.
That's the CDC. That's my country. That's the United States overseas doing that international work. But it's really the eugenics agenda. And they blanket in the AIDS thing. So they just took...
And isn't Bill Gates financing heavily vaccination programs in Africa now, like giving them billions of dollars?
You know, it's been pointed out by some of my peers that Bill Gates was under investigation for fraud all over the world, Microsoft was, until he jumped on the vaccination bandwagon and actually began to pull it with all of his weight. So go figure. The AIDS thing in Africa, though, was diagnosed by weight loss, fever, diarrhea, and itching or coughing. Lo and behold, Africa had an AIDS epidemic. Unfortunately, it had an AIDS epidemic in the 1800s too, also in the 1700s. But that doesn't really matter because nobody really cares. It had an AIDS epidemic under the king, I'm going to lose his name, of the European so-called king of Belgium, King Leopold of Belgium, who had people's heads and hands cut off for not doing what he wanted. So there was an AIDS epidemic there too, but it wasn't an HIV. No. HIV tests spread HIV in the sense that if you give somebody a test, you tell them it's for something specific, they're then terrified into believing it. They go to the doctor who says, you have a virus, a retrovirus, you may or may not die within 20 years. We're not sure. We don't really know how it works. Send more money for research, but take these drugs.
Oh, hold on. What's the difference between a virus and a retrovirus? I mean, does a retrovirus come from the 70s disco era or something?
Yes, it's a disco era virus. I'll just go with that. It's essentially a disco era virus. The answer to that is that when Watson and Crick, again, in the Western, I think they were at Cambridge, somebody can correct me, but when Watson and Crick decided that they had discovered the central molecule of life, talk about arrogance. They stole somebody else's research, a woman in their lab, and they said that they had discovered the central molecule of life, DNA. They were so sure of how it worked when they had just begun to describe it that they called their version.
I love that. You know, isn't it funny how scientists look at it this way. There's two types of science. There's the type of science where you come up with a hypothesis and then the evidence says otherwise, so you change your hypothesis. And then there's the hypothesis where the evidence doesn't support it, so you destroy the evidence and tell everybody that your hypothesis was correct the entire time. Those people get promoted and become the heads of scientific departments and research laboratories and stuff like that on them, because they can tell them at any point. If you start telling the truth about science, mate, and don't keep telling us BS and everything like that so we can sell crap to people and kill them all over the place, we're going to reveal those really nasty little sexual fantasies that you thought you had way back in the day, mate. Hey, how about them apples? We'll be right back with my very special guest for another whole hour, hopefully, Liam Sheff. Back in a minute. Talk Radio, it's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. That first hour just got out of there. It's amazing what you can get up to when you're talking about AIDS and stuff. Right, Liam Sheff is my very special guest, and we kind of wanted to wrap up this one particular topic first off, and we wanted to talk about the drug reactions, as you were telling me over the break, that they're given to all these African people.
Right. Well, they give them to the gay men here in America. They give them to any, you know, the idea that AIDS drug saves lives is an hysterical idea, because if you look up an AIDS drug, it has what the FDA in this country calls a black box warning. And the black box warning means this drug has killed people at normal doses. So I don't know, when people say life-saving AIDS drugs, you might as well say like life-saving cancer chemotherapy. If you know anything about the cancer industry, these chemotherapies kill the patients more often than not. They'll kill cells, so sometimes they'll kill a tumor, but if the patient lives for, you know, the statistical average, if they live for 5 years, they call that patient a successful cure. If they die at 5 years and one day, that was a successful cancer cure. On the other hand, if you do the Matthias Rath, Linus Pauling, high-dose intravenous vitamin C, green tea extract, NAC, glutathione, all of these things, and you live for 30 years, you're a denier of science.
Have you noticed that happens so often? How many people that are listening right now would be able to raise their hand and say, you know what, I know somebody who the doctor said had 6 months to live, and he lasted 10 years smoking pot or something?
Oh, yeah. You know, marijuana, tetrahydrocannabinol, and the other things in the marijuana plant are medicines. They're medicines, and in this country, is that illegal there?
Oh, yeah. It's illegal, but you can get it on a prescription, except no doctor will give it to you because he has to fill out all these masses of paperwork. And also, they don't want to give it to you anyway, because if they did, then they'd have heaps of other cannabis smokers and things like that who also have ailments that want to get treated for their ailments coming to see that doctor, and he doesn't want to have a practice full of cannabis smokers. So the only thing that you're allowed to be prescribed in New Zealand by a doctor, if you're lucky enough to get somebody to do it, is Sativex, which is $1,000 a month for like a little bottle extract.
Well, I mean, even hemp is hemp the non tetrahydrocannabinol plant, is that illegal there too?
Oh, you have to, it's like highly licensed, you know, like there's a couple of grows going on around New Zealand at the moment, I believe, that are growing hemp. I saw an article in Normal News a couple of years back where one of the test crops, about a 10-hectare crop, about 90% of it was eaten by birds and animals. Because humans aren't the only creature on this earth that crave and love cannabis, are we?
It's fascinating. It's an oil-bearing seed. You know, the hemp variety has no hallucinogenic potency. But what it does is that it destroys the oil industry's hold on agriculture because it doesn't need pesticides and fertilizers. They call it weed for a reason. It grows anywhere, it grows high, and it grows really fervently, and it's a great plant. We used to, in this country, used it as the prime. I mean, canvas comes from that. Jeans were made of that. And it's a wonderful fiber plant. You can build with it. You know all of this. You probably did.
The Dutch word for cannabis is canvas, and that's where the word comes from, because they made all their ship sails out of canvas, which was made from hemp.
It's a wonderful, wonderful plant. And if you don't like the THC-bearing seed, hemp doesn't have THC. It actually has some properties that diminish the potency of THC. So it's an anti-pot drug. It's an anti-pot non-drug plant that could reinvigorate economies all over the world and really destroy the pesticide business. And the pesticide business is what makes people sick around the world. That's what's making people sick all over the world. Wherever they're chasing people with vaccinations to inject them to break their skin, to put something into their muscle that was grown in some sort of pig testicle and then mixed with squalene, which is meant to wildly inflame your system, and then mixed with mercury, which is, you know, some sort of suspension that's meant to help. Whoa, it's just madness. Wherever they're doing this, you can be sure they're dousing the people with chemicals and pesticides. The reason they chase viruses is so that they don't have to stop industry. Because if they can get the public to focus on a ghost, a fear, a specter, a phantom, a vampire, you know, what did they used to do? A witch, you know, Malleus Maleficarum. They used to get people in the Middle Ages to focus on witches instead of the corruption of the church. That's what monks did. They said, oh, look out there among yourselves. There's a witch hiding among you. So that's what they do to us now. There's a witch.
And also, also, any kind of pharmacratic type practices, anybody who was tripping balls on mushrooms and doing spirit quests with peyote or anything like that, kill them!
Right. You know, we're a spiritual animal. I mean, we have kids now zoning out to video games 16 hours a day, 8 hours, you know, before class, 8 hours after class. And we're so sure that the worst thing they could do was chew on some, you know, coca leaf, or take a small bit of mushroom and actually maybe enliven that third eye of theirs, maybe get beyond the veil a little bit, and maybe, you know, penetrate this these illusions. No, we want them to play World of Warcraft or these very violent games for, you know, 12 hours a day. No, it's a madness. You know, people say that you're crazy to talk about the New World Order. Give me a break. You're soaking in it. It's, you know, we used to have a commercial. What's this? What's palm oil? Hey everybody, you're soaking in it. You know, the video game, all of these techno portals are the way that they hypnotize you. It's the way they pull you out of critical thinking, of being observant, and it's a bleeding drag. Well, the end of the AIDS story. Let's just wrap it up. There's more, and I broke a story about them essentially murdering children in New York City. They were orphans of crack addicts, and they were putting them in these AIDS experiments with these very, very toxic drugs like nevirapine. And I don't know if you can post this in the chat room. Can you post that just so people can see? I didn't make this up. I don't make any of this up. I would have made up other stuff, like, you know, really good looking girls without clothes on. That would have been the thing that I was making up But instead, I'm doing real research. If you look at this stuff, they'll publish what these drugs do. This nevirapine drug is the main drug they give to African women who test on these bogus HIV tests. This drug peels people's skins off. And the pictures are there. It actually literally stops DNA, RNA synthesis so that the skin at the dermal layer leaves. People's lips explode. Their skin explodes. And the pictures are there. I'm not making it up. So when you see these rashes that Africans are getting, they're getting them from either they're so poor that they don't have any food, they don't have any glutathione, so their DNA is unraveling for that reason, or we give them the drugs that makes their DNA unravel. So we're getting them from both ends. And now, you know, but if you're a good liberal, somehow supporting AIDS, the craziest thing in the world is liberals used to believe in sort of freedom, but supporting AIDS means that you believe that gay men and black Africans, and not white Africans, black Africans, somehow have a sex disease that everybody at University of California, Berkeley, Harvard, Yale, Cal State San Diego, the biggest party school, you know, one of the bigger party schools in the nation, all of these kids, again, bopping their brains out in the dorms, are immune. They're immune. And they'll even give you some genetic rigmarole. Well, we think that the African, oh, shut up, you know, stop poisoning them. Stop dropping crap all over them. By the way, somebody pointed out to me, Kurt Linderman, my friend from Linderman Unleashed, another radio show, pointed out, if Africans realized or could do anything about the fact that they live in the most resource-rich continent on Earth, they would own the rest of us for all the stuff they have in the ground there. There's a reason why we like to blame Africans and fear Africans and screw over Africans. We want what they have. I'll get off my soapbox now.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking about the whole eugenics aspect, basically, and it just, you look back at any of it, and it's like, what are you? Are you 100% already really intelligent, really pretty, with no defects, no diseases or anything like that? Okay, you can live. Unless, of course, you don't think that other people deserve life as well. Basically, if you're a good, decent person and you look real good and nice and everything, we don't want you. But if you look really nice and you've got everything going for you, but you're a real scumbag, then, mate, you breed away. And this is kind of what's happening, I think, is that the elite have believed for such a long, long time that they are the descendants of gods, that they are our rulers by divine right and things of that nature. Ergo, anybody that exists on this planet whatsoever that ain't 100% behind them, and even if they are 100% behind them, they've got no value whatsoever. They're simply vessels of nothingness to them, like walking through mist. They don't have that kind of human characteristic of compassion anymore, because they've had it bred out of them. They are incapable of feeling how other people feel anymore. And that's why I think that they feel perfectly justified in doing such horrible, horrendous things. Because not only can they not feel how other people feel, they don't care, even if they could.
Yeah, it's rough. I feel like I grew up in a family that was borderline. They were people, my uncle is an AIDS researcher. My grandfather, in many ways, helped invent that process of blaming retroviruses for cancer. And you can look them up. It's in my book, by the way. I mean, I own it. I admit it. I wasn't happy growing up. And I'm not on a crusade against them personally. My grandfather's passed on to the next place. And all I would ask of my uncle is that he stop and consider that poisoning people really doesn't help them get better. But believe me, you kind of can't talk to people who are in this academic mindset. You can't actually talk with them. The other stuff I talk about...
You know why you can't talk to them? Because they know everything already.
I know. You know, that was the most important lesson of my childhood. Nobody would ever say, I don't know. I mean, nobody would ever stop fighting. And I remember I was somewhere in my teens, and I was arguing with somebody, and they said, you know, I hate fighting with you because... even if you're wrong, you're not wrong. And they said, look, you're really pissing me off. I'm your friend. We're being your friend. It was a situation, you know. you're not listening to us. And I went, and I was separate. I really didn't get along with my family, but I had inherited that tendency to debate to the point of sort of, you know, just no nil value, zero sum. And I went, you know, I stopped. Thank the maker. Thank whatever was possessing me. I stopped and I said, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to make you feel that way. And I'm just afraid of being wrong. And as soon as I said that, I went, oh, I guess I was wrong. And as soon as I realized that I had been wrong about something, I realized that was freedom. Like, freedom comes from going, I don't know. As soon as you go, I don't know, you open the door to possibilities. But academics don't have the ability to say that. I don't know why. I don't know because they're, is it that they're just so sort of atheistic worshiping at the church of biological reductionism? Is it that they're afraid if they show weakness for a second, like a soldier in the army, if he shows weakness for a second, he's not good enough? It's probably all of that, but it's a drag. So these people shouldn't be in charge because they'd have no humility before the great mystery. I mean, life is essentially a great mystery. So to pretend that you walk through it knowing everything is just, you shouldn't be in charge of anything, but there they are. I just want to plop back in the book, Official Stories, again. The AIDS chapter is chapter 6, vaccines chapter 5, 9/11 chapter 4, John F. Kennedy, big turning point in this country, chapter 3, CIA is essentially chapter 1 and 2. And then in the back of the book, I get into Darwin and Big Bang Theory, because we live in what's an electrical universe, but we're still stuck in sort of this 18th century, 17th century with Isaac Newton and Immanuel Kant. So the book really, I wrote the book to be a corrective to all of the nonsense textbooks that I wrote. So any of those are open. If you want to jump into any of those, vaccines, 9/11, JFK, whatever it is, I'll just let you decide.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry about that. Technical difficulties over here at the studios, ladies and gentlemen. You know when sometimes you're using a Mac and you'll be doing something and then a little wheel will come up right in the middle of a radio interview, for example, and you've got your mic muted and you're completely fracked. Well, that just happened to me, but we're going to keep rolling on it anyway. Liam, are you still there?
Yes.
Yeah, hopefully you haven't been silent for more than 5 minutes there.
No. I just said that the book, in the book, I jumped from vaccines into the HIV. Before that is the 9/11. Before that is JFK, CIA. And in the end of the book, I get into Big Bang. Modern astronomy is another, I like your word, fracked up area of science. And I can talk about that. I could talk about Darwinism and why that version of reductionism doesn't really work. There's also a chapter on Shakespeare, which may or may not be interesting to you. It's interesting to me because Shakespeare wasn't the author of Shakespeare, in my opinion. But I want to stop the HIV talk and throw up in any of those topics. Let you choose.
Okay. Well, I think the Darwinian aspect is actually of quite a lot of interest to me. So well, let's get into that after the break with my very special guest, Liam Sheff from liamsheff.com, CHEFF, not CHEF, because he's not cooking. Not that bad. We'll be right back, folks.
There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are now listening. If you're only just tuning in to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, I'm interviewing a fabulous man named Liam Sheff, and I made a comment to him over the break I said something about AIDS and everything like that, and of course I was wrong. and he corrected me and comes up with all this evidence and lays it out and out and out and out, and it just keeps getting bigger and better. And this is the kind of thing that I really like to do. My three favorite words of all time are "I don't know." My three most hated words of all time are "I don't care." So if you're wrong and you don't care a bit that you're wrong or whatever, you got problems. If you don't know and you're pretending that you do, you got problems. I assume that everything I know to be true is in fact wrong, and I'm simply waiting for people to produce the evidence, because I obviously can't be bothered, or rather do not have the facilities to research everything on Earth, do I? That's why people specialize. They go into specific areas and things of that nature that really pique their interest, so that they can keep indulging their own addiction to information and allow other people to also partake in a communal joint being passed around sense of the word. Liam, welcome back.
Hey, thanks very much. Yeah, I said, I think when you were getting knocked off, the importance of "I don't know" in the West cannot be overstated.
It can't be understated.
Right. It's huge. My family of academics, you know, could never say that. And I learned in my teens that it was actually freedom. When you don't bunch up and put your back up and say, "Well, I'd rather be wrong and make you sorry than know what's real," you lose. So the best thing I ever learned to say was just very simple: "I don't know. I'm interested. I want to hear what you have to say." Then the world becomes a friendly place. It's a playground. And how in the world could we be convinced that we even know anything? I mean, we're these little transceivers. We're these little bits of, you know, excitable neurological synapses and some sort of, you know, spirit infusing us. How are we supposed to know everything? We're here to learn.
It's like a 50-year-old paramecium saying that I'm a young twat and don't know anything.
We were going to jump into Darwin, and I think that there's a lot. I think there's a lot there in this "I don't know"-isms. I mean, I think that's a good segue.
See, that's actually a much better form of government rather than communism or fascism, just "I don't know"-ism.
Right. Well, we're doing our best. Do you have any ideas you'd like to add?
I'm actually relishing the opportunity to just sit here and listen to you, Liam, because you know a lot of stuff that I don't. And I'd rather spend a lot more time listening and learning things that I don't already know than postulating things that I already do.
I love to sit around people who do specialize and who are generous with information. I love it when I encounter people, because God knows there's too much on Earth for any one person. That's why there's so many of us, right? We do specialize. And we actually create fields of study. You know, people will study the curve on the leg of a starfish. That'll just be their field of study. And that really fascinates them, which should tell us, you know, we're a strange species. What piqued your interest in the Darwinism thing? What did you want to hear about? I mean, I know where I want to, where I can go, but what do you want to know about it?
I feel it's basically one of the big science basics of evolution that kind of looked like and was used as a justification for eugenics. So essentially what I'm looking at doing is hopefully trying to dispel a little bit of that, maybe, or at least find out what he's really talking about. Because if you're looking at something like Darwin's works and things of that nature, microevolution, like, for example, the beak of a bird is different on one Galapagos island than another, etc., because they eat particular types of nuts, even though they're the same species of bird technically, they have these microadaptations. And eugenicists have seemed to have used microadaptation as an excuse to say, "Look, everybody else is scum except me. I'm a god. You can all die." I don't get that.
That's right. Darwin was a terrible, terrible, terrible scientist. He was a very lousy philosopher. He was a decent... Scientists used to be called something. They used to be called natural philosophers. They weren't scientists. Science now is a word that sort of rings of priests in the Middle Ages. It meant somebody who knows the truth. And in fact, the word science from the Latin scire, you can either say that it means to know or to cut. And so we look at a scientist now as this infallible person in a lab coat with spectacles, and they're saying, "Well, we believe this." And you go, "Oh." And then you hear the so-called intelligentsia running around listening to their public radio going, "Did you hear what the scientist said? The scientist said that the seals..." You know what? read their papers. They don't know what they're talking about. They're jackasses with mortgages, excuse me, and they're taking the information from their so-called superiors. They can't change any information until the last generation of, you know, so-called geniuses dies, and you can afford to upset one of them because you can't take away their mortgages. So no new ideas can come in the science or the priesthood because you tend to upset the previous generation. What happened in the 19th century, in the 1800s, after the Reformation, what happened post-Renaissance Reformation was that people wanted to get away from the single answer. There was a single answer, and it was always, it's because God made it so. Well, what made this bird different than this bird? Well, God made it so. Well, what made this landmass look like this?
You know what? That sounds an awful lot like what parents tell their children, because I said so.
Right. That's not a mistake, right? We project into, and listen, I don't know where you stand. It doesn't really matter to me, but I'm a spiritualist. I have my spiritual. I lean east, is what I say. But I think that religion, any time that it binds itself into a literal telling of a story, gets it completely wrong, because literalism is really the enemy of, in many ways, of a greater understanding, especially of myth. And also, these stories are written by people, and they're written over 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, and they're written in a time and place. Then they're translated, and then they're mistranslated, and so on and so forth. So as soon as you bind yourself to an allegory, literally, well, he said there was one loaf of bread, not two. You know what? It doesn't matter, because you're missing the point. The point of any of these allegories is to get into the myth beneath it. But the problem with the sciences of the 1700s is that, as we see in the story of Galileo, you couldn't really do it. Because if you upset the dogma of the church, you couldn't practice your philosophy. Science then had to break away, and it did. They called themselves natural philosophers. They philosophized. They sought knowledge, philos. They loved to seek knowledge. And they then decided to observe the thing that they could observe, which was nature. Ergo, they're natural philosophers. They weren't scientists. They didn't know. They observed. Different field. Darwin was a natural philosopher, but he became what we would call, at least we think of him as a scientist. He wasn't. He got on a boat. He went to different places. He said, these birds, even though they're all finches, have different beaks. These lizards look like this, and these, and then he came up with an idea. No, he didn't. He wasn't the first to come up with it. During Darwin's time, there were a number of philosophers. Even Darwin's grandfather was Erasmus Darwin, came up with a pattern of categorizing animals and life forms. They were trying to put them into sort of a tree. What came from what? Where? How did this come about? Because the Christian model was everything was created at once. It was created on the fourth or fifth day, or whatever day it was created, sixth day, and that's what happened. And the natural philosophers, said, well, hold on a second, that's a myth. We're not going to buy the six-day thing. Come on, we have these bones now that we're finding for animals that have never lived. Things have changed. Things have not always been the same. So let's try to figure out how life comes about. Darwin said, we have birds with different length of beaks and different length of wings. How did this happen? His idea was not a scientific idea. His idea was an anti-religious idea. And this is where we live now. All of Western science is predicated in two bits of science. One is Big Bang Theory. Big Bang Theory.
What I love about the Big Bang Theory is, like, everything came from nothing, right? And the other irony here is that science has become, as you said, sort of anti-religious. But ironically, all the founding fathers of science, you know, Newton and all these guys, were actually deep spiritual believing guys who also had the knowledge and the belief that science should be something for measuring the physical world, not for denying the spiritual one.
Yeah, they did. They were deists or animists. But when I say that Darwin came up with an anti-religious idea, I mean a scientific idea is something you could test. It's something you can measure and something you can do, just to use the word again, science with. You can do experiments with. An anti-religious idea is life has no purpose. Because the religious idea is life has a purpose. Whatever the religion is, all religions say life has a purpose. And they all decide what the purpose is. An anti-religious idea is life has no purpose. It's an accident. Darwin's idea was not one he came from observation, because observation sees that life is patterned, organized, creative, structured, and improvisatorial. It improvises with structure, shape, form. All of these identities are improvised across all of the forms. And instead of saying nature, which I'll use as a stand-in for a higher energy source that I cannot identify, is wildly creative, he said, life is a stupid, dumb, mute accident that randomly decides, for reasons that have no bearing on the environmental, no reciprocal relationship with the environment, accidentally a bird will be born with a big beak or a small beak. And either that is advantageous in an environment or it is not. This is the Darwinian idea of evolution, then, is life is a huge accident. So a cell comes about. He doesn't explain why a cell would come about. He doesn't feel that he has to. Even though his book is called The Origin of Species, he doesn't explain where species come from. All he says is changes happen by accident. And we've been stuck with that, canard, for 150 or so years. But that's not the way life works. Life is responsive to the environment. Cells respond to the environment at the subcellular microscopic level.
Well, you know what? This actually does sound like an anti-God thing, because the whole Luciferian ideology and the belief structure behind that is to tell everybody the opposite of what you think to be true, so that they'll all go off doing basically stupid stuff where you can sit back and laugh at them.
That's sort of outside of my wheelhouse. I haven't studied that sort of thing, because again, I don't want to be accused of being a religious literalist, fundamentalist.
But these aren't my beliefs or your beliefs or anything. This is just people who actually were in the Church of Satan saying that that kind of thing. Because I interviewed a guy named Mark Passio, used to be a priest for them, kind of thing, and that's what he told me.
That's new on me. That's interesting.
I'll send you the link to the interview. It was really fascinating.
And I will listen to it. I was listening to your interviews before I came on the show. I enjoy the fact that you, as the English say, take the piss out of a lot of it. I mean, this whole New World Order stuff is a drag, but, you know, the Romans essentially in 20 AD lived under a New World Order. It just happened to encompass the Mediterranean. You know, the Greeks lived under their New World Order until they tore themselves apart in civil war between Sparta and Athens. So we are a species with a particular repetitive nature, and I think it's summed up very beautifully in one of the Vedas. It might be the Rig Veda, I'm not sure. One of the Hindu spirituals, which says all of this has happened before, all of this will happen again. And I really love that idea, because it takes a little pressure off of you. You know, we're not here to fix the world. We're here to fight for what we know is good. That makes it a lot easier.
You know what? In fact, that's something that that kind of spurred me on and did all the sort of things. You know, I was going through a couple of bad jobs and stuff like that, really hated it. And I said to my friend, John Eisen, who does Uncensored Magazine here, I feel like quitting. And he didn't ask me, you know, how's your financial situation or what did they do or anything. He just asked me, does it feel right? Yeah, it does. And that's basically, I think, the main principle that we should all be following in our lives, kind of thing. If you want to be happy, if you want to accomplish something decent in your life that you can actually be proud of, ask yourself the question before you're going to do it. Does it feel right?
Exactly. And consider it. Let it sit for a few days, a few hours, a few weeks, whatever you need. But those resilient feelings and answers that, you know, eat well, clean your body, because, you know, we internalize the thoughts that we have. I think we tune them in from the greater energy source, whatever you want to call it. But if you have a really polluted body, it's going to be pretty hard. You're going to get a lot of, you know, crackly static. And so people eating the fast food, microwaved, hydrogenated, so-and-so genetically modified, I think that we're impacting our livers. And the Chinese looked at the liver, by the way, as the center of health, center of the body, not the heart, not even some idea of white blood cells or the immune system. The liver, which cleans the blood, gets rid of the poison, and you store energy, and it also, modern science will tell you, performs some 500 functions, was the center of the body to them. So liver congestion, you're going to feel angry, gummed up, screwed up in the head. They didn't worry about the brain as we do now for depression, they worried about the liver. And it makes a lot of sense. And you can figure this out, too.
Indeed. And we only, unfortunately, have one more segment with you, Liam. And if you'd be willing to stay on after that to have a chat with the listeners, we normally do that after each show. So you can, you know, just be personal. And that's not recorded. It's unprofessional. But it's a hell of a lot of fun to talk with people from all over the world. So if you're keen, we will. But we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, for one more segment at the very least with Liam Shat. Back in a few minutes.
And gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water?
What you know, ladies and gentlemen, about scumbaggery? You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I love to expose scumbaggery. In fact, I even have a t-shirt. You know those I Heart New York t-shirts? Well, I've got one that says I Heart to Expose Scumbaggery, and it's great. Especially wearing it when I ambush the Prime Sinister. With a camera, my very special guest, final segment here, Liam Shat. Thank you very much for spending so much time with us, man. I'm sure you're very busy. Now, we were talking over the break about how I was kind of saying to you that I'm not 100% sure who I am, exactly why I'm here, what my future's going to be, yada, yada, that kind of thing. Everybody gets that. And you said that it's actually a timing thing.
Well, you know, I believe you're 27.
Yeah.
You know, the 20s are a place of grabbing a hold of, I think you either grab yourself by the lapels if you're not sort of doing things and say, look, at some point in my 20s anyway, I said, you really have to stop screwing around with thinking that your problems are going to be solved by some girl or some adventure or something like that. So what is it that you want to do? I said this to myself. I was about 26. I said, kid, what do you want to do with your life? This is your life. It's not anybody else's. And I went back to school and I worked really hard. And I did it sounds maybe the bravest thing in a way that I ever did was I studied the things that I really wanted to study. That means that I didn't study the things that I thought family would approve of. And that's a shocking thing to do. Some people never, ever break away from that. But I had to say, even if they decide that they hate me and don't speak to me anymore, I have to pursue this. I needed to study music. And I needed to study foreign language, and I spent 4 years doing it, and I loved it. And you said you're doing something that you're doing, and you love it. You're not exactly sure where it will take you. That's exactly the way I felt. I'm a decent musician, but there, you know, I mean, I would see the kids come in, the young kids who'd been sort of playing since they were in utero, and you know, they could just vroom 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 all over. And I have a good head for theory, and I can play some improvisatorial jazz. And look, I'm not bad, but. But I knew that I wouldn't be Bill Evans. You know, the great Dave Brubeck, Bill Evans, the guys that I really admired in piano. I thought, I'm not hitting that level. And I had to decide not to give it up, but to ask myself, and it actually came through a healing crisis. I got really, really sick, and I had to look at a lot of different things in my life. And it all happened between 30 and 31. And there's this period from about 27 to 30, 29 to 31 or so, that the old astrologers will call the Saturn return. And the planet Saturn is a very, very large gassy planet. We didn't even get to, maybe we'll have the, maybe have me back on, we'll talk about the electric universe. Blow your mind, you'll love it. But the gassy planets are actually low voltage stars. They're just not receiving a lot of current from the galaxy, so they don't glow. But the Saturn is a, takes about 29 years to get around. And Saturn is the planet that in astrology, in Western astrology, carries the burden of paternal, judgmental, sort of grandfatherly judgment. This is what you must do. It's all the thou shalts, all the things that you ever, thou shalt do this, thou shalt do that. And you have to break away from all the thou shalts in your life.
I think you can't break away from one of them, though. One of them is very important. Thou shalt not take thyself too seriously.
You might have to break away from that just to get back to it. I don't know. But you break away from all of these thou shalts and you face them. I don't know. Everybody's path is a little different. But I had to face the thou shalt from my family, where you must study the this and the science and then these things, and also, and you must not defy parental authority and all these other crazy things. And then you come through this period and it's this traumatic, yeah, where am I headed? What am I doing? And you keep doing the thing, you keep listening, and if you hold fast to the things that really, really speak to you, and you might even have to make apologies to people who thought that you were supposed to go here or there. You might have to say, I'm not doing this despite you. I absolutely feel that I have to go this way, and I'm sorry if it upsets you. And they call this the Saturn return. And it's the point where all of these thou shalts come back into your life, and they bop you over the head, and you face them again, and you go, who am I going to be? Am I going to comply with all the thou shalts, or am I going to, you know, are there some of them that make sense to me? Some of them might make sense to me. Just the one you said might make sense to you. But then you may encounter others, and you have to go, I actually have to reject this, not out of spite. And I came through that, and I moved from language studies, which I was very good. Believe me, I loved language. I could have taught Latin languages, Romance languages, and I could have traveled Europe, and it would have been a great joy. But I'm a conspiracy guy, you know, and that was sort of underneath my skin. And I needed to give that a chance. And you wouldn't have known that about me at 27. You might have known it about me more than I knew it about myself, because I had put it away. Then by 30, 31, I'm like, I got to start talking about all these questions that I have. And I had to. So you're in that phase, that turnaround. And at 31, I mean, you are in an interesting position, because at 27, you have this very big, well-known product that is you, that is the stuff that you do, and you can turn around and you could become a filmmaker, and you could turn around and become a novelist. Who knows? You could become you could defy everybody's expectations, get a job in the mainstream media, and secretly seek to sabotage it in every single way. Who knows?
Well, the thing is, I don't need to be part of the mainstream media in order to sabotage it.
Yes, for the people who aren't watching, he just gave me a good eyebrow raise. You're right, you don't. I'm just saying, it's impressive what you've done at 27. You know, at 27, I was sort of pulling myself together from the wreckage of a relationship that had gone on for too long, and I was pulling myself back into school, and I was taking the work very seriously. Like I said, I really said to myself, kid, not screwing around time anymore. I felt a pressure on my back to get started. And it was a good thing that I did, because, you know, by 32, I was a journalist and I was writing long, long, heavily detailed, serious articles. So I don't know. I don't know what that's good for, except telling people to stay true to those things that speak to you consistently. And I don't mean the fear-based things. I don't mean like, oh, mom will be upset if I do this. That's the thing that you have to go, you know what? I will upset people in my life. The question is, what does my spirit want? You know, tells you.
In fact, we had a conversation with one of the listeners on the Skype chat one day, and I used the word truther, and she didn't like the word truther because she interpreted it as something bad, something COINTELPRO, etc. And telling me not to talk about other things and certain things. And I said to her, look, I'm not going to stop talking about things before you've told me what they are, okay? I'm not going to self-censor myself when I don't know what I should censor and what I shouldn't. I'm just going to say whatever feel is the truth and real for me. And if somebody does get offended, then I'll say sorry and stop talking about it around them.
I like that point. And the funny thing is, you know, if you come out and you question like HIV tests because the medical literature tells you to, the mainstream will call you a science denialist or an AIDS denier. You're not anything of the sort, but just by pointing the finger and yelling at you that way, they convince amateurs, you know, onlookers, to not get involved. Now, they've chosen people who want to tell the truth, and this relates to 9/11, which was an intelligence operation, clearly, definitively an intelligence operation that got the entire U.S. air grid to stand down, the most armed, rabid military in the world, to just ignore everything that was going on. Please. They were manipulated. They were pawns. They had proxies inside the government. It was an intelligence operation. So to call people who know this and talk about it, to call them truthers as a pejorative, what you think? Take it to its logical conclusion. The opposite of that is to call somebody a liar. So the opposite of a truther is a liar. The mainstream is saying, don't be a truther, but they don't finish their sentence. Be a liar? That's what they want you to be.
Be a slave. It's great fun.
Right. Now, we won't finish, and we're going to run out of time, I guess. And I'm happy to stay and answer questions from the audience. I'm actually thrilled to. But the end of the Darwin thing was that life doesn't happen by accident. Nobody can tell you the beginning or end of life. Big Bang Theory, by the way, was invented by a priest called George Lemaître. A priest. I'll say it again. Big Bang Theory is not a testable science. It's an imaginative nonsense invented by a priest who aligned it with biblical Genesis. As far as we can tell, the universe has no beginning, no end, and life is an intelligent process. It's reciprocal. We'll never really understand it, but it's certainly not a big dumb accident.
Yeah. Well, look at it this way. You're either a conspiracy theorist who believes that there are powerful forces that actually use their power to maintain their power, or you're a coincidence theorist who thinks everything happens by accident. And there's no relationships, there's no backroom deals, there's no nothing. Which of those two groups of people sounds really insane? The people who think that there are connections, that there is such a thing as power, or the people think that there's no such thing at all? Those people sound freaking nuts, don't they? They sound like they're in full denial of reality. And this is what I've been talking about for a long time, Liam, is that when you're walking around the street and you see people that are looking down, who aren't doing anything, and then you see a homeless guy with a sign saying the end is nigh, he's not the one who's out of his freaking mind crazy. It's actually the person who thinks that there's nothing going on is just going to their job.
Everybody's a little version of delusional in this world. Everybody's got a touch.
Yeah, like Freemasonry. It's just a matter of degrees.
It's a matter
of... All right, Liam, well, thank you very much for coming on the show with me today. And also, if you are listening to the live stream, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com or AmericanFreedomRadio.com, you can join us in the chat room at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com if you want to join in and have a chat with Liam and myself and a number of the other listeners after the show. Just go to the chat room at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and you can pop in your Skype name there and I will be adding you into the conversation. Other than that, thank you very much for listening. Thank you so much. And by the way, we're now bigger than the New Zealand Herald on YouTube. That's the biggest paper in the country with the biggest YouTube channel. So I'm officially New Zealand's number one YouTube reporter, even bigger than the mainstream media. Scumbags. Pathetic slime are very easy to beat because, hey, they think that they're unassailable. And it's arrogance that winds up getting you killed. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.